So this work has been funded by the Air Force under the MURI that Paul is leading. And I'll just give a little bit of a blurb here. Those of you who actually have funding from the Department of Defense, you're actually eligible to get high-performance computing resources, which are actually quite ample and don't require a lot of work to actually get. If you want to find out more about that, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. I just want to highlight the people who did the work. The original work I'm going to talk about was formulated with Hulakal Krishnamurthy, who's at the IISc in Bangalore, and the postdoctoral fellow who worked on it is Carlos Mikkelsens. And now Andreas Dirks is the new postdoctoral fellow who's working on this project, and a lot of the later work I'm going to talk about is from him. Some of the work I'm going to mention has some has been done by other people as well, but the primary stuff I'm talking about has been done by these three people. So I want to start by explaining what exactly is the problem that has relevance to cold molecules that I've been interested in for a couple of years now. And it's trying to deal with the bottleneck in forming cold molecules, which is the efficiency for forming them during the Feshbach sweep, which is typically about 20% efficient. And our idea for how to improve that efficiency is to do what we call preforming molecules. So if you consider the rubidium-potassium experiment, where these red ions are bosonic rubidium and the yellows are the fermionic potassium, this would be a situation at a high temperature where I have particles spread out and not very much correlation between them. But if there's a strong enough attraction between the potassium and the rubidium for the interspecies attraction, at a low enough temperature I can get into this situation where I have exactly one potassium and one rubidium on each lattice site. And then it's our belief that if you were then to do a Feshbach sweep, you would get nearly 100% conversion of these preformed molecules into the halo molecules, which can then be down-converted into the ground state using the stirrup process.
Jim, yeah. Did you say attraction? I mean, why do you need attraction? Can you just make that sort of independent, bond insulator or something?
So this is an idea that a number of people have had, was to look at perhaps doing a band insulator for the fermions and a Mott insulator for the bosons, and then trying to put them together. There are two potential problems with that. The first is that typically the size of the clouds is not the same, so you're not going to get perfect overlap. And the second is that if you just look at the volume versus surface area, so to speak, of these things, the vast majority of the particles are actually, even if I create a Mott insulator, because of the trap, it's going to tail off and have a lower density farther away, similar with a band insulator. And the vast majority of the particles are actually in those outer regions. If I have an attraction, I can actually get into a situation where even in an outer region where it's dilute, the two will sit on top of the same site predominantly, and they'll have vacancies with empty sites. So it's likely having this kind of an attraction will still greatly improve things. And because you have to be at the interspecies Feshbach resonance, it's not like this is a hard thing to do. You just have to set out a bias where you have a net attractive interaction before you do the sweep. It's relatively simple.
Sorry, I didn't understand. But I would say that the point of Alexei is correct. So if U12 is smaller than U11 and U22, it acts like an effective attraction in the mode. So if they prefer to be...
There is no U11 if one is the fermion. These fermions are spinless fermions.
Well, in this case, it's definitely the case. So what it means is that the bosons, they don't want to be in the
You still, if you have an attraction, it's still going to be better to get the two forming on the same site. Because if I'm in a dilute limit, it will be more energetically favorable if there's a repulsion between them to have one on one site and one on another site. You're thinking about the concentrated limit, but as I said, the vast majority of these are in the dilute limit, and you're going to lose if you have that. Now, the problem is you can't have the attraction too strong, because if you have the attraction too strong, you'll have two bosons and one fermion, and that typically leads to destructive collisions, and the particles get lost out of the system. So it requires somewhat fine-tuning,
So you use this Spinor's formula, do you actually mean you select one, for example, one spin component of the atom with only mirror lattice, and then this is like you assume like basically have a Spinor's formula?
That's right. That's typically the way these experiments are done. They'll load it into one state, and they'll have that one state loaded into the system. That's right. Now, one of the questions that you have to come up with, that you have to confront when you're trying to do this, is the question of whether or not an equilibrium formalism or a non-equilibrium formalism is the appropriate one to consider. An equilibrium calculation is good if the system is essentially represented well by the long time average after the thing has thermalized. But in general, when they're trying to make these, particularly in something like the Innsbruck experiment, where they're looking at rubidium and cesium that they're trying to put together, they're forming these objects far from one another, and then they're going to create a little conduit and pour one of the species on top of the other. And it's a highly non-equilibrium situation that they're engaging in. And the question is, how well is this going to work in a non-equilibrium case? And so this is what motivated us, in part, to start looking at non-equilibrium ideas. But let me flash up for you. First, let me tell you the model that one uses to describe these two species when there's a significant mass difference between the two. It's called the Falikov-Kimball model. The red particles you can think of as light fermions, and they can hop between different sites on the lattice. The blue squares are the heavy, either fermions or bosons. In the case of KRB, it would be bosons. And they're localized. They don't actually move from site to site. But when the two particles are on the same site, there's a interaction U between them, which can be attractive or repulsive. And for this model, the many-body physics comes from the fact that you take an annealed average over all possible, all possible fermion configurations. This is work that was done with Paul and some other people. We looked at this in equilibrium with a strong coupling perturbation theory. This is a plot of the entropy per particle, which is a measure of the temperature of the system. And this is a plot of the efficiency for the preformed molecules. What is the probability that I have exactly one species of each particle on a particular site at a given time? And you can see, depending upon what the attraction is between the two species, as long as it's attractive enough that I'm in this strong coupling regime, you actually get nearly universal behavior for plots of the entropy versus the efficiency. And so it's a pretty robust phenomenon. Pretty much you just tune the attractive interaction to an appropriate regime, and out will come a pretty high efficiency if you can get down to entropies on the order of 1 kb or less per particle, which is aggressive given the current temperatures that these experiments are being operated at.
So how do you compute that? How do you compute
that? This is an equilibrium calculation, so entropy is completely well defined.
How do you compute it? I mean, you have a collection of particles, right? So how do you compute entropy?
It's essentially the log of the number of configurations. And you have to count. And for the fermions, you have rho log rho plus 1 minus rho log 1 minus rho. For the bosons, you have an n log n that you have to sum over all possible configurations.
Do you assume that you sort of have the same number of fermions as localized?
In this case, we have an equal number, yeah. For these calculations, we took an equal number. That's not something that is required by the calculation. We could do it if there's an overage of one versus the other. In a typical KRB experiment, you would expect an overage of rubidium, just because it's easy to create large clouds of rubidium.
And are you going to come to preparation, or you assume that that's just going to settle?
For an equilibrium calculation, this is basically what you get. So this is what I would say is sort of an upper bound of how good I'm going to get. I wouldn't expect, if I take into account non-equilibrium effects, I'm going to do better than this.
Right.
Now, how much worse I do, I don't know.
So you're not going to talk about it.
Well, that's what we'd ultimately like to do, but now I'm going to talk about the non-equilibrium formalism in general. We're not yet at the point where we can do this calculation, okay? It's a pretty hard calculation, yeah.
Let's let Jim tell his story a little bit, and just a few slides, and then we'll know what he's doing. Because
just one second. So you said this is the parameters you're thinking are not really realistic.
No, well, for the equilibrium calculation, no, they're the realistic parameters you get for a particular lattice depth of a potassium-rubidium mixture. No, I just said that it's pretty aggressive to have an entropy of kb per particle given, I think the current experiments at Gila are more like, what do they tend to quote, 7, 5, 7, something like that. But I mean, they're not really pushing to get at the absolute lowest temperature. I mean, certainly an entropy of 1 kb per particle is not unrealistic given what current cooling technologies are. With these mixtures, you have to deal with the gravitational sag and other things like that in order to make it actually work. But it's not something that's, you know, similar like finding antiferromagnetism in a fermionic system, which is, as we know, much harder.
So you consider not consider any harmonic confinement?
Excuse me?
So you consider an homogeneous lattice, so there is no overall...
Oh, no, this is with a trap.
It's with a trap?
Yeah, it's with a trap. It's a 300 by 300 lattice
with a
trap.
With a harmonic trap.
The harmonic trap is taken to be the same for both species because the polarization of potassium and rubidium turns out to be very similar. But you can adjust that depending upon a particular species you're doing the calculation. These calculations are extraordinarily fast. You know, they take less than an hour on a laptop to, you know, run these kinds of things in this strong coupling expansion. They're very efficient. So now I'm going to talk about the strong coupling approach to non-equilibrium in the Hubbard model. And the idea that we have is that for the atomic problem, if I have no hopping and I just have essentially a site that has a U that could be time dependent between a spin up and a spin down particle, and I have a chemical potential, that's all I can have on a local site if it's a Hubbard model, you can actually solve exactly for all of the Green's functions of such a system. It's not trivial to do, but you can get an exact expression for it. So then we're going to turn on the hopping as a perturbation. And because it's in non-equilibrium, because we don't have time translation invariance, we have to work on the so-called Kadnoff-Bain-Keldysh contour, which involves propagation forward in time, propagation backward in time, and then propagation along an imaginary axis, which describes the initial thermalization of the system. The challenge with any strong coupling calculation when you do perturbation theory is that you don't have Wick's theorem. So you can't just take your expectation value of four creation and annihilation operators and replace it by the averages of the two squares. Instead, you have to actually calculate that thing. But as I said, you can calculate it directly for the case when the hopping is equal to zero, and then you just perturb about that point. The perturbation theory, however, has to be a self-consistent perturbation theory that includes an infinite order of terms, otherwise you don't get damping in your system. And damping is very important in non-equilibrium because you want to see how some non-equilibrium excitation decays over a period of time.
Jim, yeah. So the problems you can solve exactly, that's the problem of what, one boson and one fermion with a single orbital of each on a site? Is that the problem?
Well, right now I'm talking about fermions. So it's any number. I mean, we typically would use a grand canonical type of ensemble. So there'd be a chemical potential, which could be time dependent, and a interaction U, which can be time dependent, and then a constraint on the filling.
So you're now talking about an up and a... up and down fermions in a single orbital?
Or that's right. That's right.
We're taking the full harmonic.
We'll eventually be taking the full harmonic potential, but in the atomic limit, each one of them, they just have a different chemical potential. The form of the Hamiltonian is the same for all of them.
I'm trying to see why you're saying, why is it hard? I mean, it shouldn't be like really easy then if you take only a single orbital and then up and a down fermion there?
Well, because I have, you know, it's a four, a two particle. Correlator is a C dagger of T, C of T1, C of T2, C dagger of T3, C of T4. I have 24 time orderings. Each of the evolutions involves an integral of the U of T as a time ordered product between each of those terms. It's not trivial.
I mean, if it's some small matrices, right, basically exponentiating time dependent small matrices like 4x4 something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not trivial, but yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be easily done. In equilibrium, you can actually get the exact analytic expressions for what these are. So the thing that I was just talking about is actually this kind of a blob. This is a two-particle propagator. It would have two creation, two destruction operators in it. This is a diagrammatic series for the Green's function in terms of the bare Green's function, which is the Green's function for the atomic problem. And then this isn't what you would think of as an interaction line. This is the hopping term. So this site and this site would be nearest neighbors connected by a hopping, for example. Okay? And so you can work out a diagrammatic series out to whatever order that you want. This is one that's truncated now to second order in the hopping, which I'm using J to indicate the hopping here. And if I resum this, what I do is instead of using the bare propagator here, I use the full propagator here, which is then self-consistently. And then I also put the full propagator here. Okay? And then that makes a self-consistent perturbation theory that I have to solve. The challenge from the numerics is, depending upon the scaling that I've done on that Keldysh contour, the calculation of this goes like n to the fourth. So it's worse than typical matrix calculations. Yeah?
You didn't write down your actual Hamiltonian, you just said Feldkamp-Kimball model.
So this particular one is Hubbard.
This is just Hubbard?
This is Hubbard.
Yeah, and so you all this interactionist hopping and all that business, you neglected. Is that right?
No. This is the perturbation theory. So this is the hopping.
This is the
diagram for the hopping.
I understand that.
Yeah,
but
okay.
There's a four-operator term that also does hopping. If you have a particle here, it can sort of, spur hopping over here. There are these longer-range terms. You've neglected all of those. It's the usual Hubbard model. Is that right?
Usual Hubbard model. That's
okay.
Right. Nearest neighbor hopping.
Yeah.
And a U, on-site U.
So all the Green's functions here is actually Keldysh.
Of course, yeah. Everything. These are two-time Green's functions. Yeah.
What is the N here?
N would be the discretization of this contour. How many points did I take? Okay. So your accuracy is governed by how big that delta T is. We typically will run at a couple of different values of delta T and then scale to the delta T goes to zero limit, because you actually want to be solving this for continuous matrix operators, which we only know how to handle by going from discrete ones and scaling them to the continuous limit. Okay, so the first problem I want to talk about is the problem of block oscillation. So here I'm just going to turn on a constant electric field at a particular time and watch what happens to the system as it evolves. And here's a plot of two different things. This is the current, this is the total energy. Let's focus first on the current. There are two different cases here. One, where the electric field is equal in magnitude to the U value, the correlation value. That's a case where I have a resonant ability to absorb energy, because the electric field that corresponds to accelerating the particle from one lattice site to another lattice site is equal to U. Those energies match, and so I can actually easily move particles around and sort of resonantly absorb energy. And so you can see that in the case where the field is along the diagonal, these are calculations on a simple cubic lattice, you actually get into something that's like a damped oscillator, underdamped oscillator, that oscillates around the infinite temperature limit for the double occupancy and very rapidly gets up to this high temperature limit. On the other hand, if I make the electric field much larger, then it's difficult to actually absorb energy by the system, because the electric field is too big. I can't just create a double occupancy to absorb it. I have to have a multi-particle process to do it. What tends to happen in that case, if it's along the diagonal, it's more striking than if it's along just one of the lattice directions. You get into a region where you're not close to the infinite temperature limit, which is where you would have expected to be able to go as you heat up the system. But instead, you get stuck in some transient state that you can't get out of. And this is a plot of the current in that state, particularly for the case where the field is along an axial direction. The current is essentially going to zero here. And when the current goes to zero, I can no longer add energy into the system, because the change in energy in the system from Joule's law is E dot J. When J is equal to zero, my energy doesn't change in the system anymore. in the case where I'm along the diagonal, it looks like I might be able to do it, but it seems like what is happening is however much I'm putting in, I end up then taking out again. And so the net effect is that this thing isn't changing very much.
So maybe you could translate it in the simpler terms, right? So basically, I mean, the particles are neutral, right? So it's electric field is...
You would have to think of this as a...
So you are basically like...
You can think of it as a tilting of the lattice. Right? Yeah, you can just adding a tilted potential to it.
So how does it compare, for example, MGH, a typical MGH across, I mean, say, between two lattice sites, how does it compare to the typical U?
Oh, I think the gravitational thing is way smaller than what these things are. I mean...
How do you...
Otherwise, I can't trap these things. I have a tilted potential. I have a tilted potential.
Okay.
And the slope of that is E.
But how do you tilt it?
Oh, they can do this experimentally by putting a light sheet on the thing. They can create a tilted potential fairly easily.
You can also take two different frequencies. It's actually a tilting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you change the frequencies, you have to change the frequencies. The other way that you can think of it is, I have these guys, and they're sort of spatially localized by inertia, and then if I pull my lattice through the system, that's what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. If I have my standing wave in a moving frame, and I pull the lattice through, that's the equivalent of this as well. So there are two different ways that you can do this. Yeah.
So are you saying this is pretty much exact, that you try smaller and smaller delta t and nothing?
This is scaled as best we can, so the delta t goes to zero.
And do you feel like it's pretty much exact?
Well, I would not feel confident saying I know for sure the current's zero here. Because if it's e to the minus 10, you know, and if I weighted e to the 10 time units and the thing started actually absorbing some energy, I couldn't tell you about that. But what is happening is that there definitely is a transient regime that this thing gets stuck into that either evolves with a time scale that is so long we can't see it in these calculations, or it just is actually stuck in here and it never thermalizes. Okay. I don't know what the answer is. My suspicion is it's the former, that the current is just very, very small. And if one waited long enough, eventually the thing would thermalize into this infinite temperature limit.
If you take a small system, you know that this method, you know, works, you know. You can compare it to an exact calculation that works, you know, perfectly, right?
We have done this with a 4x4. I mean, a 4-sight lattice with exact diagonalization.
And then it works perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Until the 4-sight thing starts to do its periodic repeating, which they can do. The small system sometimes will repeat.
And that is not captured by this?
Well, because this is a much bigger system we're solving.
I meant you can reproduce the foresight behavior with this approach pretty much exactly if you made delta
t. I'm not 100% sure whether we get the repeating or not. I mean, this is an approximation still because it's a truncated perturbation theory. We didn't include all terms in the expansion. We can only go so far. So there is an approximation in here. It's just in the strong coupling limit, it's likely this approximation is a very good approximation.
Because I understand this problem always as a two sides, so to say, that if you tilt and you are exactly at U, as you have this EU 100, basically you become resonant with the line between 1,
right.
1 into 0, 2, so to say.
That's right.
Then if you are... Instead of being at 100, you are actually at half, from 0.5, 0.0, then you are again non-resonant, and then the transport must be also very small.
I'll show you results at other
values. What is more surprising for me is the 4.4.4, because at 4.4.4, the jump is large, and still you have a signal. This is strange, no?
Well, I can drive current. These guys are getting accelerated, so they are able to drive through the system. It's just I can't. It's in many respects similar to what happens if there are no interactions in the system, where you get a block oscillation that just lasts forever.
Yes, but here you are at 4, which is here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what it means is that if you jump here, you are losing basically 3, so to say, units of U, because you have here 1, 1, when you jump here, you have one U, but here you have four, so to say. So you are losing three U's, and your T is supposed to be much smaller than U. Mm-hmm. So this means that the process is very non-resonant, so to say.
That's why I can't absorb the energy. Okay, but it still can push the particles through the system.
But if you had more bands, you might have a different story.
If there were higher bands, these things could likely go into higher bands.
Yeah, you are not considering higher bands.
No, just single band. Just single band.
And is this the non-adiabatic band, so that you don't have energy conservation because you don't have adiabaticity in the process?
I don't have energy conservation because I'm accelerating electrons with a force. Okay, I'm actually doing work on these particles. Okay, there's no way to do adiabatic.
Well, I mean, USB becomes resonance enhancement, but if you have just non-adiabatic, you can always drive the system.
Yes, but you are just tilting it, so to say. Now is you have tilted it already, so to say. Now you have to look for the conservation of energy.
You still
but it's
drive
time.
It, just the amplitude is small.
The other parts are quite clear, but this amplitude, the amplitude of the red curve, which was the 100, the 400 to say is very small, so this can, but the other one is significantly larger for the 444, which is somehow surprising.
How small is T? How small is J?
It's 1 over 24, I think. 1/24th of U.
1/24th
of U.
So
everything's in units of U.
So it should be like 1 over 24 squared of the amplitude.
So the bandwidth is half of U.
Half of
you.
Oh, okay.
And with this 12.
Oh, okay.
And with this half of you.
Okay.
All right, so here's a plot of the density of states. This is what you get in equilibrium. This is long time density of states. This is what you get in equilibrium. For different fields, you can see that generically you get a very sharp structure. The sharp structure is coming from the fact that there are these coherent oscillations that are long-lived, and they are also in the Green's function. They give rise to sharp peaks that occur. In the resonant case, however, that doesn't happen because the system very rapidly absorbs the energy. You don't get quite as sharp peaks. This resonance that occurs here is occurring from a matching. If I think in terms of the Vanier-Stark ladder, and I think in terms of the shift by an energy U, what happens is two Vanier-Stark ladders get both shifted down, one from the left, one from the right, one shifted up, one shifted down. They meet at U and they cause a resonant enhancement in the system, which gives this peak that appears here. If I look at it instead along the axial direction, along a single direction, then most of these density of the states look very similar, only in this case where I had this resonant matching of the Vanier-Stark ladder do I see a two-peak structure. And in this case, where it's equal to 1, there's some extra bump that seems to be present here. But the rest of these here at 0.25, at 0.75, and at 1.25, they actually all look very similar to one another. And in fact, there is sort of a quasi-universal scaling. There's one that we see when we're on resonance, when E is equal to U. And here we're looking at a variety of different J values. And we rescale. This is the current as a function of time, both scaled by the hopping, and you can see the curves nearly lie on top of one another. And this is the density of states as well, scaled appropriately. And you can see that those shapes change very little when I'm on resonance. I didn't include the plot, but there are some similar scaling that we saw, which you got a hint of with that earlier plot of the density of states that occurs when you're not on resonance as well. The next problem we've looked at is lattice modulation spectroscopy. This is a situation where you take the potential that's holding the atoms and you modulate the amplitude of that potential up and down with some frequency. And if you do it with an appropriate frequency, you'll create double occupancies. And what the experiments do is they vary the frequency, and they look at the number of double occupancies that are created as a function of time. This is one of the recent experiments. Most of these experiments have been done by the Esslinger group in Zurich. And this is one of their data points for the evolution as a function of time of the double occupancy. Here is our calculation for a homogeneous system with the same parameters as they use in the experiment. And the only thing that we have to adjust is the temperature of the initial system before we start the calculation. And you can see here, at this temperature, we're pretty darn close to this experimental data. So this is one of the reasons why I like to argue that these strong coupling approaches can be very accurate ways of looking at these systems in the region where they work. They often fail miserably if you try to push them beyond that region, but in the region where they work, they can be very accurate.
Does it matter that, I mean, are they perfectly the thermal ensemble there, or they've done some ramping things?
I think they've done the things that they always do with these. You know, you have to turn on the lattice at some finite rate and so forth. So, you know, how long did they wait, and were they really in a thermal distribution before they start? Not clear. Okay, I don't think any experimentalists would say for sure they know that they're in a thermal situation before they get started. There's sort of a protocol that nearly all of them follow that they think is a quasi-adiabatic way of turning the lattice on, but it's not completely clear whether or not that's really true, and I don't know that anyone has tried to really test that to see how accurate that is. In our calculation, we're assuming it's perfect thermal equilibrium at this particular temperature before we turn on the vibration of the lattice potential.
So if they were ideal, they would do it isentropically, right, and not isothermally. So ideal,
I haven't looked carefully at the paper to find out whether or not they actually quoted what they think their temperature is. Okay, but I am planning on asking them if it's not in that paper to see whether or not they know what it is. But this temperature is typical of the kinds of things that they would be at. When the U is fairly large, getting down to order of about a tenth of U, that's typically where they can get down to. So this is not a typical value. Now, if you look at the fact that U over half the bandwidth is 4.1, that means U is 24 times J. So this is 1/6 of U. It's 4 times the hopping. Okay, it's a high temperature. And all of this strong coupling approach really works at high temperature. Okay, but all of the experiments are at high temperature. That's why it's a good thing to try for these systems.
Jim, what was the species here now?
This is potassium.
What potassium?
Potassium 40. It's a fermion.
It's a fermion.
Yeah, potassium 40. Here's a plot of resonances that we see in the ability to absorb when the frequency is equal to U and when the frequency is equal to a half of U. Now, this is driving at a very high nonlinear rate. The previous one was at a 20% modulation. This is at a 50% modulation. So much higher amplitude driving rate where we should be in the nonlinear response regime. And so you can see the expected resonance when I'm equal to U, because then I'm putting in an energy H bar omega equals U, and I should be able to create double occupancies, which cost U. But I also get a pretty good amount of double occupancies created when I'm at a half U. And you can interpret this as essentially being a nonlinear process where, if you like, two photons are combining to give me an energy of U, and then I'm using that in a nonlinear way to absorb energy. Because if I go slightly above, this is 0.67, or I go slightly above 1.43, you can see it's not that easy to get the energy absorbed by the system. And so we can plot that. It's kind of like a spectroscopy. As a function of the driving frequency, we can ask how much double occupancy do I get at a particular time. And here you see the nice peak around U. And then this is the smaller nonlinear peak that I'm getting around a half U. If we can increase the amplitude further, we would expect to get even more complicated behavior here in the lower frequency regime. It actually becomes difficult to restrict yourselves to a single band model if you make this potential at some point too small. And so there's only so far that we can actually do that. We're probably not going to go much higher than 50%.
Just one point. I mean, those numbers, I mean, this 0.07, it turns out being a very small number for the frequency. I mean, it's far from one, right?
But this is a large U. So, I mean, this is a U of 180. Mm-hmm. Okay? So before I turn this on, it's essentially zero. Mm-hmm. Okay? And now that when I turn this on, you know, I'm getting up to 7%. This is only over a particular time. We can only run these calculations so far out in time before this n to the fourth kills us. And we can't run it any further in time. This isn't the maximum that you would get. This is just what you get after you've run it for a particular period of time. Okay?
So if you had bosons here, how would it change the picture?
I don't know. Ask me in a year when we do our boson calculation. I mean, there are more possibilities for bosons because I can get double occupancies and triple occupancies.
Yeah, but
so
the one half, you still expect that this.
I think it's higher. A pretty generic effect. I would expect that I'd see a peak at a half. I think you can see in some of the data a little bit of something. They usually don't push the amplitude this far.
Yeah, I think in the original first experiment of Essinger with bosons already in 2004 or something, I think they had a peak at 1.5 or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is some. I think you can see some.
Postulated that it was an ordinary effect.
Yeah, I think you can see some of this in some of the data that's already there.
Yeah, but Jim, I thought you were very careful in your answer, but you know, clearly with bosons you're going to get more resonances, and an easy guess is that there'll be a third, and you know, et cetera. And you should also.
Well, I don't know about that, but they'll certainly be at 2U and so forth. They'll be more higher up. I don't know that it'll necessarily be more lower down.
Okay, I probably said it.
Okay,
backwards.
But the real question is, at what amplitude do you start to see the nonlinearity?
Uh-huh.
Okay, is it easier with bosons? So at a smaller amplitude, I'll start to see the nonlinearity, or is it harder? And I'm not really sure what the answer is to that.
If I think in terms of like a multi-photon theory for 2-7, then I would expect that I would have to modulate at a frequency at an amplitude which is comparable to the frequency of modulation, to the H barometer of the frequency. Because in this way, my system will absorb the amplitude and create a frequency. It's the typical way. So if now, now you are driving at a frequency which is U0, to the same, and you would like to take all this with an amplitude of modulation which is, I don't know, which is
50%.
50%. Yes. So it depends how much is this amplitude of modulation in terms of the Rayleigh frequency, which is U0, and this will tell you more or less the number of harmonics, right? the amplitude of the harmonic. It's like in multiphoton theory.
Uh-huh.
So if you take delta V and divide it by omega, how much do you get? Delta V over U0.
So
that's, you know.
Well, I need to know what U is in recoils, which I'm not sure. Okay, the delta V is measured in the recoils, and then the U is also measured in recoils at the 15 recoils. I just don't know exactly what that is. People might know 15 recoils is pretty big. It's probably like 40 or 50, something like that. I mean, U over T is like 40 or 50, but I don't know exactly what the U is relative to the recoil depth. It's usually a small fraction, though, isn't it? Like a tenth or smaller, the U relative to the recoil?
Yeah.
The recoil depth, isn't that what typically comes out, like a tenth or even smaller? Okay. Okay. There's no noise. It's periodically oscillated, just a sinusoidal oscillation up and down of the potential. That gives a more complicated oscillation of U over J, okay, because the J is exponentially dependent and the U depends more weakly on the lattice depth. So there actually are periods where nothing is happening. When it gets deeper, the hopping gets so small that this thing is essentially in a quiet region, and then all the excitation occurs when the amplitude is small, hopping gets really big, and so forth.
How do you choose the interval then?
We're just taking a sinusoidal modulation up and down.
So with a constant amplitude for the interval?
Yeah, we're just driving it. We're just driving. So we start at some time and we just drive it.
Because I would expect that the turn on is then relatively sudden, so to speak, compared to the change.
Well, but we turn it on deeper first. So there's very little.
Nice.
We turn it on deeper first, and then it comes up. And so these plateaus are where it's deep, and then this is where it's shallow, then that's deep, and then shallow, and so forth. So you can just follow it that way. When it gets deeper, essentially nothing happens. But when it gets shallow, that's when you get the excitation.
So we're making a speculation that it's probably just two photon bosons. Is there a way of digging somehow into the numerics and, you know, checking that that's the right effective description, or you just sort of have to just...
I don't really know how to do that.
Tweak something, room something.
I don't know how to do that. I mean, but what else could it be?
Yeah, but no, in this case, probably pretty obvious, but it's some, you know...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to do that. If you have an idea, I'm happy to entertain. I'm happy to entertain hearing an idea about that. So the last thing I want to talk about is, and what I think is an interesting perspective for thinking about thermalization in these systems by looking at what is happening to the Green's functions as functions of time. Those of us who work in many-body physics, particularly those who work in equilibrium many-body physics, never think of Green's functions as a function of time. Everything is a function of frequency. I want to show you that actually there's a lot of benefit of thinking about these things as functions of time when it comes to non-equilibrium. And there's a lot of interesting things that can happen. So the first thing I want to look at is what I call causality for a two-time Green's function. So the Green's function depends on two times. If both times are before the field is turned on or before my perturbation is turned on, then the system is in its initial equilibrium state and I get the equilibrium Green's function. Now, this is for the retarded Green's function. If both times are turned on after the field has been turned on, particularly if it's a constant field, and now I'm going to go back to the block oscillation problem where I turn on a constant field and I just watch what happens. If both times are after, then it looks like the equilibrium steady state retarded Green's function. Why is it the steady state? Because the retarded Green's function tells me what the states are of the system. All of the thermalization and stuff occurs in the lesser Green's function, which tells me how those states are occupied. So when both times are after, it looks like the equilibrium, non-equilibrium steady state. When one is before and one is after, I have a mixed Green's function. And in that case, it turns out that it actually interpolates between these two limits. And what I want to show you are first a sort of waterfall-like picture. Average time is increasing upward in this picture. Blue is the region where the thing should be described by the equilibrium Green's function. And these curves are shifted for clarity. That's all that the horizontal axis is giving. And so this is what I would call the causality line. This is the point where I go from both times being in equilibrium to one being in equilibrium, one being when the field has been turned on. So that line comes in as the average time goes up and eventually comes all the way into zero. And then it starts moving out. And as it moves out, I start having two times after the field is turned on. That's the red part, which then start approaching the steady state picture for what the Green's function approaches. And you can see then that this green one, which is the mixed, is actually interpolating between this thing that's oscillating for a very long time, because this is in this transient state, and the equilibrium one, which is dying off once the relative time gets big enough because I have a nice bandwidth in my system. This oscillation is telling me I have a very sharp peak in my system. It's probably, if it really goes on forever, it'll become a delta function peak. But if it eventually thermalizes, it'll just be a very, very narrow peak governed by whatever that width is for how this decays. So we can see this as well with a movie that I'm going to show you here. This line is the causality line. Red curve is the non-equilibrium. Black is the equilibrium. Now I'm coming out in the non-equilibrium. And you can see even after the causality line, it agrees very well with the steady state for a period of time. This is going to just keep repeating until you don't want me to show it to you anymore. But you can very clearly see that the mixed part, which is after the dashed line, is really interpolating between these two and typically is decaying on a time scale that's much faster than whatever. If one of them is not decaying, this mixed one decays on a faster time scale than the one that doesn't decay. Another thing that happens when you're at half filling, which is what these calculations are, you can prove that the imaginary part of the lesser Green's function in time representation is equal to, they should say, imaginary part of the retarded Green's function divided by 2, although the retarded Green's function is purely imaginary in this case, so it actually is a correct result. Sorry about that. I have a feeling this is going to come up a couple of times. Let's hope that it doesn't. And here is a plot that shows that. So the black curve is the retarded Green's function. The blue curve is one half the retarded Green's function, and the red curve is the imaginary part of the lesser Green's function, and you can see they essentially agree. Now, the retarded Green's function only is non-zero when the relative time is positive. The lesser Green's function is non-zero for either positive or negative relative time, and this occurs essentially immediately once that two times or after the field has been turned on, when the relative time is long enough that this thing has decayed, then I get this picture. And now that then tells me that the thermalization actually comes from the way the real part of the lesser Green's function behaves as a function of time. And what we found when we looked at this in the Hubbard model, unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any simple way that the real part of the lesser Green's function behaves as a function of time. But when we looked at this for the Falikov-Kimball model, we found that it has a particular shape that seems to just decay exponentially with some time constant. And I'll show that to you here. This is the real part of the lesser Green's function as a function of relative time for different average times. And now, unfortunately, the average time is increasing as I go down as opposed to up. So this big black curve is a picture at an early average time that has a fairly large amplitude. If I look at it at a longer time, it has essentially the same shape. It's just its amplitude has been reduced by an exponential factor in the average time. This now allows me to predict exactly what this lesser Green's function is as a function of time, even beyond where I can do the calculation. And because if I have the lesser Green's function and I have the retarded Green's function, I can then extract the self-energy, both the lesser and the retarded self-energy. I can then put that into a calculation and calculate anything that I want at any time. So this is essentially solving the problem of the fact that I can't go that far out in time in my calculations, because now I have everything I need to predict what's going to happen to the system as it undergoes the thermalization. Now, we were hopeful that this was also going to work for the Hubbard model, but it turns out it just doesn't seem to fit this scenario as well for the Hubbard model. There's more variation of this real part of the lesser Green's function as a function of time. But when I put that together now for the Falikov-Kimball model, this is the Fourier transform of the imaginary part of the lesser Green's function, and it doesn't change as a function of average time. It has this shape. It's proportional to the retarded Green's function, which is the density of states. This is the Fourier transform of the real part of the lesser Green's function, which is an asymmetric term. It's an odd function. And when I add the two together, I get the actual density of states and how it evolves as a function of time as this thing evolves towards the infinite temperature, and what it's getting to pretty closely in this particular case, because by the end, this curve is actually quite small. And then I just have one slide of telling you a little bit about what it is we're going to be doing.
I'm actually not sure I know what the lesser Green's function is, but what is the conclusion about this? I understood how you said that there's, if you take one time before and one after, that gives you the interpolation. So, but then I missed how.
This is a situation when both times are after. Okay, so I'm in the state where I have a field. And I'm trying to watch what is happening to this. How is it approaching the infinite temperature limit as I'm pumping energy into the system? And what we find is that you can understand that if you think of it. See, if I think of it as a function of frequency, I see this, I think it's the blue curve is the one that I see. So this blue curve as a function of time looks very complicated. Okay, but if I decompose it into the part coming from the imaginary part and the part coming from the real part, I get a much simpler picture. And so what we're saying is that all of the thermalization, all of the variation of this is coming from this. And that actually turns out to have a very simple dependence on time because it behaves like this.
But how does this relate to your first slide in this section where you have sort of one time before and one after?
Okay, so this is corresponding to the case where both times are after, and I have, because I have a finite bandwidth here, the final guy looks like this, has a finite bandwidth. This one is going to have a Fourier transform that decays. So once I have both times such that, in essence, both times for the relative times are beyond the width of this, or 2 pi over this width when I think of it in terms of time, then whatever's happening at the really long times when one is before and one is after, I don't care about, because the Green's function is essentially zero out there. It doesn't affect what is happening to the system. Okay? And so this then allows me to get at thermalization in this system without having to do a calculation out to really, really long times. I can actually pick it up by figuring out what's going on. In particular, I can get at the steady state Green's function, what the limit is going to be, by just looking at the imaginary part of this Green's function once the times are big enough. If I can get out to this sort of transient but long enough time, I can then figure out what the thing is going to look like for all further times.
Yeah,
So that's what we, and for the Falco-Kimmel model, it seems to work beautifully. For the Hubbard model, not quite as well. At least it's not as systematic at all. It still is true that the imaginary part is nice and constant, and the real part is where all the thermalization is taking place. It's just not true that it has a simple exponential decay as a function of average time.
Can that change dimensions? What does it change? If you go to lower dimensions, what does it happen?
Yeah, lower dimensions become more problematic for us. These strong coupling calculations, I think, are most accurate in high dimensions. So this work is actually an infinite dimensional non-equilibrium dynamical mean field theory calculation. The Hubbard model stuff is a three-dimensional Hubbard system.
So the other question is, does it count because so the fact that you get different kind of behavior of time, is it a pure effect of the physics or also from the fact that it becomes much less precise?
In the region where we can do the calculation is quite accurate.
So you show okay. That the time evolution that you're seeing
we think that it's good enough that we can extrapolate what is happening. Now, what I can't say for the Hubbard model is that it eventually goes again to this Falco-Kimball-like paradigm where there's just some envelope and some exponential decay, but that just occurs at much longer times than we can do the calculation out to. Okay, I can't rule that out from happening. I just don't know what's happening once we get to times beyond where I can do the calculation. It's just there's nothing that seems to be systematic about how it's behaving. It seems to just have very complicated behavior. Yeah. So the final thing we want to do is we want to actually do these calculations now for an inhomogeneous system in the trap. And it turns out that the expansion is exactly the same, except you have to work in real space rather than momentum space. And you have to use self-consistency where you have to carefully note that this guy depends upon two sites, or actually this guy doesn't, but some of these Green's functions that enter into these calculations will depend upon two different sites, and you want to look at the different sites that are the neighbors of the site that you are at, which in real space are going to vary as I move from one position to another position. And so the calculation becomes a lot more complicated in order to carry out. But we have a lot of techniques that we can use. Part of the problem involves taking the inverse of a very large block sparse matrix. And we can use an iterative technique called GM-res. And we can also do local truncations because functions tend to die off as the relative time gets large or as the relative separation gets large. And so we can just truncate after it's big enough and not worry about things that are farther out. And using those two, we think that we're going to have results for a two-dimensional non-equilibrium system in a trap with this modulation spectroscopy maybe in a few months, maybe by the end of the summer. So that's where we're currently heading with this. And with that, I'll just put up my conclusions. I showed you how we're hoping to apply this strong coupling approach to the molecule problem. And I showed you how we've developed a non-equilibrium approach that looks like it works very well when the coupling strength is large. I applied it to block oscillations, modulation spectroscopy, and also got some insights into thermalization by looking at this. Okay. And if there are more questions, we've had a lot already.
Well, let's thank Jim first. And we can have some questions. Sounds good.
How does your scaling depend on what order you go to in perturbation theory?
Okay, so if I go to third order, it's going to go like n to the sixth. Okay, and we decided that that was sufficiently painful. One of the things that we're able to do with this is we can actually calculate the elements of that tensor on the fly. So we don't actually have to store it. Storing it is actually, if I have 1,000 time steps and it's n to the fourth, I have to have 10 to the 12th elements that I store. It becomes impossible. But we can actually calculate them on the fly as we need them, and then it doesn't, so we don't actually have to store them. But for n to the sixth, it's really going to be compute time that's going to kill us.
Yeah, because you do that, that's what parallelizes so well, is just parallelizing over configuration.
Well, not really configuration, but you take the workload, in this case when it's translationally invariant, you can take the workload for each momentum point, and you can put that onto a different processor. In some cases, I'm not sure whether he's actually done that, in some cases the different matrix operations or manipulations can also then be further further dissected and sent to different processors to process as well.
So for these processes that you were showing, it related also to Michael's question. So does it mean that if you go to a higher order, you'll get more precise, or can you also make the delta t smaller and effectively not have to do the higher order? How did it work?
No, you definitely, making the delta t smaller is not going to preclude the fact that you're neglecting processes that will occur at higher order if you don't include the higher order terms. It could very well be, for example, it could very well be that if I go to second order, I can't see the long time multiparticle process that gives rise to the decay of this transient state. It's just not in the theory. So for the theory, it'll just be constant for all time. Whereas if I solved it exactly, maybe the time scale is 10 to the fourth of my 10 to the fourth times the time that I ended. And I could actually see it if I had the exact theory, but it just isn't even in this truncated approximation that we're looking at. So we don't know the answer to that.
So if you check if they're small, you said you can compute them on the fly in higher order terms.
We can't compute the full higher order. We can compute this correlation, this two-particle correlation function, which involves four fermion operators. We can compute that on the fly for the different times that you're going to have. We cannot compute the self-consistent solution of the higher order thing without going to a higher order in which to try this. One thing I didn't mention is if you do the first order calculation, that's actually RPA. And so even if you include an infinite number of diagrams, which is what you need to do to get RPA, it still has no damping. So this is the first non-trivial calculation you can do that has damping in it, which is really critical for describing these non-equilibrium systems. Yeah.
I always wanted to ask you more about these methods because I've heard you speak about them a few times, so I think this seems like a good time here at KITB.
Okay.
So what is it that the strong coupling expansion can and cannot do? So for example, can it see the disorder transition, the weak to strong disorder transition? Could it observe something like that? Or you can't deal with disorder? You were talking about not getting recurrences, so I imagine that due to this truncation,
well,
maybe you missed things.
We haven't applied this with disorder to too many problems, but back many, many years ago when I first introduced this to the Bose-Hubbard model, we did look at disorder there. And there, what we felt confident we could study was the transition from the Mott insulator to the Bose glass as a function of disorder.
Okay.
What we did not know how to address was the transition from the Bose glass to the superfluid with this technique, because we didn't know what is the signature. What we used was the fact that the Mott insulator is not compressible and the Bose glass is compressible. And so we just found, where does the system become compressible? And that was the criterion we used. That's the same criterion we used in the pure case to go from the Mott insulator to the superfluid. We just asked, when does it become compressible? I don't know what the right criterion is that determines the transition from the Bose glass to the superfluid. I don't know whether other people have actually tried to apply this technique and think they know how to do that, but I was never able to figure that out.
Okay, so let me give another example. So could you look at some kind of space local phenomenon if you wanted to know what critical velocity was in one of these fermionic systems? Could you take an obstruction, move it across, and look at the response?
Well, so I think anything that involves superfluidity or superconductivity is particularly difficult for this approach.
Okay.
So it's particularly good when you're in the Mott phase,
okay,
or when you're perturbed about the Mott phase in some fashion.
Because J is.
That just seems to be the limit where things work quite well with this approach.
Okay. But you can look at a local modulation of potential, since after all you're doing the harmonic trap, so that's not a problem. So, you know, if you wanted to look at, I don't know, a tunneling process where you had a well, if something was escaping, you
sure,
could do
I think
that
we could
here.
Do that, yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, we could do dipole, once we get this inhomogeneous thing working, we could do dipole oscillations. we could, you know, either oscillate the trap and watch how it, or we can just impulse the trap and then watch the thing slosh back and forth, you know, and decay.
I just think it's such an interesting kind of calculation to do, because, I mean, after all, on the superfluid side, you know, at least long wavelength, you know, I'm not sure we even need such advanced methods, you know, but on the Mott side, I mean, we really don't have, especially for thermal effects and looking at how, you know, frequencies change as you...
And the other thing that I would say is every time I've looked at these things and tried to compare them to experiment, I'm always surprised at how well it seems to work even beyond where you think the thing should break down. It just seems to work better than it really should.
So last question about limits of the algorithm. Michael asked some technical questions about scaling, but just about what you can actually apply it to in case one of us wants to try it sometime. It looks like it really does depend on some kind of local terms in the Hamiltonian. Is that correct? I mean, your perturbative term happened to be local. If your non-perturbative part was non-local, would that be okay? Would you work in a basis where, suppose you had only direct...
So the strong coupling approach is really predicated on there being an atomic limit that you can solve exactly. So something that involves nearest neighbor interactions, I don't think we can handle with this. It has to have some kind of on-site interaction. And with the on-site interaction that you can then solve exactly. So what is the difference between the Fermi model and the Bose model for the Hubbard model? With the Bose model, I just have more states, okay? And I have a change in the statistics. I'm evaluating commutators instead of anti-commutators, but everything is essentially the same. It's just more states that I have to put in. If the U is big enough, I can stop before I get to too many states, and we're going to have to put that into the calculation. We only will have some number of occupancies before we have to stop within a given calculation. So there's a little bit more overhead because there are extra states that are possible that I have to worry about, which is why we started with the Fermi problem rather than the Bose problem. But it's a pretty straightforward modification, and I don't think the compute time is exorbitantly higher in order to do that.
Just to finish answering this question, because I just don't understand the answer fully. So,
all right.
So why is it that you can't have just a nearest neighbor interaction? I mean, it's still somehow diagonal. So I don't know that part of the Hamiltonian.
There is no interaction in the atomic limit. Atomic limit is one site.
That's what atomic limit means.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Everything's happening on one site.
Okay.
So I don't know how to do that. Uh-huh. That kind of an expansion. Now, maybe there's a cluster way of generalizing this where you start from, you know, a two site,
right,
and then try and expand it into multiple sites, right, or something like that. Those techniques are often highly non-trivial to develop. Okay. I mean, when dynamical mean field theory was introduced, people wanted to then go to, you know, the next correction. Instead of a single site, they wanted to do a two site and this and that. It took years before it was worked out how you properly do that. What tends to happen is you lose causality. You get negative densities of states, other weird things like that happen. This is well known from the alloy theory back in the 70s and 80s when they were trying to go beyond the coherent potential approximation in order to figure out how to include more spatial correlations and so forth. So within dynamical mean field theory, that problem was solved. There are two different cluster techniques that people use to solve it. So it might be that looking at that literature, one could figure out an appropriate way to try to start looking at cluster extensions. It's likely to be very difficult to get that sorted out and get it to work properly.
Okay, that really clarifies a lot of things. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I'd like to know how well would it work in one dimension, because there you would benchmark some dynamic studies. But
yeah, so that is one thing that we probably should try, because there's a lot of density matrix renormalization group calculations in 1D that have been done. We haven't done that, okay? In terms of compute time, it's actually easier for us to do 1D than it is 2D or 3D, because we have far fewer sites we have to worry about in order to do it. The experience that I have by looking at the Bose-Hubbard model and also Fermi-Hubbard model for equilibrium properties is 1D is where the accuracy is the worst. So it's likely we're not going to get incredibly good agreement between the two techniques, and it will be unclear how that then translates into higher dimensions. But I still think it's worthwhile to think about trying to look at those kinds of comparisons just to see. Because as I said, I often, when I compare things, I get surprised by how well it seems to work.
I am suggesting it though, because I mean, these methods exist in London already, but it's often quite heavy to have finite temperature and dynamics.
Yeah, and so that might actually be a problem with trying to make the comparison, because we got to be at pretty high temperature. So you got to be able to do the DMRG at a pretty high temperature.
You can't go to zero temperature if you want.
Often the technique just fails. Okay, you know, a typical rule of thumb is you can take the temperature down to the order of the hopping, but not below the hopping. Now that seems to be more of a hard and fast rule with the Fermi system than with the Bose system. Seems like the Bose system you can bring down to lower temperature and it still seems to work reasonably well. But for the Fermi systems, you really have a breakdown when you try to get below about on the order of the hopping. Maybe it's the hopping over 2 or something. And I suspect those are temperatures that are pretty high and aggressive for a DMRG calculation.
So another question sort of about the limits of this approach. So it's a strong coupling approach, but then you consider the situation where you're, say, you're hopping, you tilt the lattice and your hopping becomes sort of resonant, and similarly you consider, you know, oscillating the lattice at the rate that, you know, hopping again sort of becomes resonant. Should I be worried about the applicability of the strong coupling limit where you suddenly introduce these resonant processes, there is no gap preventing these processes that should be small from happening, or is it as applicable in these cases as it is in all the other cases?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know what the answer is to that.
So it might be less accurate actually for those resonant processes.
I'm not really sure. It becomes a question of, you know, what is it that is governing the way that it's converging? Is it converging because there's a gap in the system? Or is it simply converging because the hopping scale is small compared to the correlation scale? Okay?
And you don't know.
And I don't know the answer to that. Because, you know, there are just that many exact techniques out there that we can compare to. So what are some of the surprises that we've gotten from this that we're a little suspicious of? So one is the fact that we don't see any decay of this transient metastable state. That's a surprise that we got that we're a little concerned about. Okay. I don't think there's been any real surprises with the modulation spectroscopy yet. I mean, it just seems to be giving us the kind of physics we expect to see. The one case of data that we can compare to experiment, it looks like it agrees pretty good to that experimental data. So we haven't had any real red flags, but you always have to be worried that there could be a problem with the fact that it's just an approximation. So one of the things we were worrying about with the thermalization problem, which is why we compare Falikov-Kimball, where we really have an exact solution, and Hubbard, where we don't, is to see, you know, what are results that we think are really generic about these different problems, and what are results that could be consequences of the approximation itself.
But it's easy to take a, you know, a small system with, you know, 2 sites that you can solve exactly and check whether hitting these resonances suddenly makes the approach, you know, much worse.
There are some cases with the small cluster calculations that are giving us things that we don't fully understand, but we still aren't able to really know exactly what is the problem. Okay.
I mean, I think
it's a hard one to answer. I mean,
I think the basic problem is that this technique is so orthogonal to the other numerical methods we have. It's just really hard to benchmark it, you know. And it's just the one, you know. It's good. Maybe the experiments are ultimately the way to benchmark, as you've been pointing out. But I think that's kind of what Alexei is getting at. You know, is there some other numerical method or analytical benchmarking? I mean, how do you address that? I mean, how do you know you have the right answer other than convergence?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for example, what we saw with comparing strong coupling perturbation theory on a small cluster with the exact ionization on the small cluster. I think, if I remember correctly, the main thing that we saw was at short times, everything was perfect. It agreed perfectly. And then we got into a regime where the strong coupling perturbation theory did one thing, and then we started seeing things that were looking more like recurrence behavior in the small cluster calculation that were not being reproduced in the strong coupling. Now, is that a function? And we also could see that if the interaction was made too small, there were serious deviations between the two. So we know that if the interaction is made too small, we get closer to the Fermi liquid regime, this thing just doesn't work well, and that's expected, okay? And we also saw that there's a potential that something weird could be happening at long times, but we weren't convinced that the problem wasn't with the small cluster calculation and not, because the system is too small and not this approximation.
I think your interpretation is right, that these recurrences are to be expected in the exact diagonalization, and in your method, because you have truncations, you won't get them. And I think that's actually correct interpretation. So,
I would like to come back to the original motivation about the performer liquid problem, because up to which point is really relevant for an experimentalist who wants to just produce molecules. Whether I have many holes, few holes or not, because if I am an experimentalist and the only thing that I want to do is to have molecules, I don't care too much whether I have holes or so, because I just ramp up. And if I have two sites occupied, whether I have several holes or not, is not so relevant for me. It is relevant, for example, of course, if I want to get to a sort of quantum phase or to a sort of this anti-ferromagnetic coordinate or so. But here, what I want to do is something much more basic, which is just to form molecules. So up to which point it is very important whether I have single occupied sites here and there or holes here and there and so on. Because I would say that...
I think if you talk to any experimentalist working on this, they will always tell you that they would rather have more molecules than less.
Yes, but
and if it's a very small, if it's a very small change of the experiment to get me to have a lot more, it's really advantageous to do that.
Because to eliminate holes to a very low entropy is actually quite a lot of work experimentally.
No, but this isn't that low of an entropy. If you look here, already at an entropy of 2 per particle, I'm at 50%, and that's pretty uniform. Here maybe it's 55% here. I mean, it's pretty uniform. An entropy of 2 per particle is, I think, quite reasonable to achieve in these systems if people wanted to go after that.
For example, if I am in a system,
and that's improving efficiency by 2.5%.
So what if I'm in a system in which I have a mod in the center and a sort of not mod, a metallic phase outside, because here you are talking about fermion boson, for example. But this means that in the center I have a large probability that if I ramp up my lattice,
I will
get a large probability to get dominance in the middle.
Yeah, but
in the metallic phase, also the entropy helps me, because I have some probability also to have dominance there.
Yeah, but if you do the counting, of the number of sites and of the what you're going to get if you try to do that, I can guarantee you if you plotted your plot on the same plot that I did here, so go take your mod insulators, put it on a real 3D lattice, and calculate these numbers for me. Okay, I can guarantee you you're going to do worse than what I'm doing here.
But it's a factor of 1.
And the fact that I have to be on a Feshbach resonance biased to the attractive interaction before I do the Feshbach sweep anyway. This is going to just win.
You're coming back to this same point you asked earlier. Can we close and let you guys continue to discuss this? Because some people are starting to get ready to go. And is that okay?
That's fine by me.
Okay. They can continue the discussion. So let's thank Jim again for a great talk.